This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I'm excited today to be joined by Jason Williams. Jason is the senior leader at Change Healthcare, a brilliant person, a great leader. Jason, can you take a moment to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do at Change?
Thanks, Scott. You're too kind. And just to return the compliment, it was a great Becker's event that you all allowed me to participate in with the Health IT and Revenue Cycle Conference earlier this month. As you mentioned, I'm a technology product leader in healthcare IT for over 20 years now. At Change Healthcare, I'm VP of Product Management. I lead a portfolio of provider revenue management software, analytics, and AI-powered solutions.
Thank you. And some people don't sort of understand how large in size or scope Change Healthcare is. Can you take one moment and just give us some sense of it?
Sure. It's interesting because I do find myself explaining Change Healthcare more often than I would expect sometimes. Change Healthcare is a $3 billion technology and services firm. We've got, I believe, over 14,000 employees that serve providers as well as payers and consumers by way of workflow software, analytics, technology-enabled services, imaging, clinical decision support, and I'm sure some other things I'm missing. A lot of folks will recognize some of our legacy brands like Relay Health and MDON.
You lead a big portfolio of products, and how do you think about strategy and how you develop those products, how you merchandise or market those products, how you stay engaged with your customers and your team? How do you sort of go about thinking about strategy and business development?
So there's a lot there. And but my first thought whenever anyone brings up strategy is the best definition of strategy that I've heard is it's a series of maneuvers to win. Strategy is about winning. And I think, you know, sometimes, especially in healthcare, because of the altruistic nature of the mission, that people take their eye off of, you know, what is winning in that mission. You know, it doesn't just apply to sports or to commercial businesses. I've been on some nonprofit boards, for example, where they didn't recognize that they needed to frame what it is that they're trying to win and what their tactics for going about winning were going to be. So in the provider world, you know, there's a difference in sustaining your organization and truly winning, you know, growing your patient capture, service lines, finding new opportunities for patient revenue as well. So I believe once you define what it is you're trying to win, how you plan to win, you have to know, it informs rather what you're not going to do, you know, what you're not going to waste your time and effort on. You know, I find that, you know, our teams, you know, they're always trying to be helpful, right? And it's not always that they're not well aligned toward a particular objective and in particular tactics toward that objective. You know, they're pulling, but they're not pulling in the same direction. And when that happens, you don't get significant movement. And so that's what we try to strive for with our teams is when we're trying to define what winning is for us, it has to equate to what winning is for the providers that we serve. And that takes on several elements, and those have to be clear to all of my teams that things like not only the pursuit of cost containment, but where do we find additional opportunities to create net patient revenue? Where do we find opportunities to not be a drag on consumer loyalty, if not something that's accretive to trying to drive consumer loyalty for the folks that we serve? One other thing I'd just say about strategy in general is, you know, there's kind of casting the strategy and the objective and how you want to go about winning. But I think I've learned this from coaches. Coaches now, they don't just look at the scoreboard and then, you know, throw more drills at the next practice. They've learned to manage in-game stats nowadays. And how do you make adjustments before the scoreboard and you see an outcome that you don't like? And for us, the scoreboards are a lot of times your monthly or quarterly reports. That shouldn't be what drives your action. Where the action should come from more and more often is from real-time analytics, AI predictions and automations, the kind of in-game measures that we can change our trajectory before you end up with a monthly or a quarterly or an annual report that's unsatisfactory.
Thank you. And you mentioned something fascinating, particularly in the revenue cycle world. You could be an A-plus in revenue cycle, But if you do an A-plus or 100% revenue cycle, but you harm patient loyalty and patient and consumer loyalty, then you've really not long run solved the problem or really been an A-plus performer. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think about the fact that I think you all have reported this as well as some other sources. The clinical experience, the clinical patient experience, a lot of times may be an hour, it may be a week, but the patient overall consumer experience may start weeks before that, and it may extend months after that. And a lot of surveys have been done where they've basically been able to ferret out that the experience that someone has in that longer arc, that weeks to months that surround the care experience, really drive whether or not they have a good or a bad taste in their mouth with a provider organization. So performing in that way not only is accretive to the measurements that they have against patient satisfaction, but it also, from a financial impact standpoint, matters because those are the same people who are going to decide whether or not they want to come back to seek care with your organization or tell other people or refer them into your family as well.
Well, no, and it's so true. You start early on with admission into the system and however you're going to start showing insurance and those kinds of things. And then in the back end, it's collections and so forth. And quite frankly, if a patient has a bad experience with those kinds of things, it impacts their overall view of the system. And they might still go to the system because they absolutely have to go to, but if they feel bad about the overall patient experience outside of the quality, when they have a choice, when they don't feel like they have to go to the hospital for this thing, they'll go elsewhere. And so it's a fascinating perspective that you bring to it in tying those two things together. Another question for you, Jason, any thoughts on sort of overriding healthcare trends that you see? And I know it's another broad, ridiculous question, but any thoughts on healthcare trends that you see and what do you see as it applies to you folks?
So it's broad, but absolutely not ridiculous. At least a couple things that come to mind. One, obviously we're in technology, and so I believe healthcare technology trends are starting to converge with general technology trends. And I'm referring to the fact that a lot of times in the past, you know, we in healthcare have been viewed as being behind in implementing technology. But now we have had core systems in place for a number of years. We've lived with financial and clinical information systems. And the next logical step is to start to scale adoption of technology that takes advantage of the data that gets accumulated in those systems. So much like in other industries, we're starting down the path now of doing things in artificial intelligence, mobile applications now. And you've seen, you know, some of the consumer mobile application players really start to migrate more into healthcare. You're even starting to hear about technologies that are Internet of Things, you know, trying to integrate, you know, the Alexa type assistants into the healthcare environment. So that's those trends in healthcare on more of the current edge of technology, I think are going to continue and accelerate. Second, just alluding to the discussion we were just having, I think that patient experience that we're all trying to manage is going to become different because a lot of times the way we're managing the experience now is to provide better transparency to make the patient or the consumer a better passenger in the car, if you will. And I think that's going to continue and shift toward being more the driver of the car and the driver of the process, you know, really at the head of the care team and the administrative team, if you will. You, as you were mentioning that patient experience earlier, I thought of an example. There was a person in Texas that did some shopping on their own and decided that none of the providers in their local area were priced where they wanted to be. And they actually drove 5 hours to have an outpatient procedure and then drove themselves back after that. And I think it's the extreme example of my point of the patient's going to be driving the process and not as much of a participant or a bystander in the process. And that's an adjustment that we're going to have to make. And the last thing that comes to mind with regard to your question is, I think the trend in partnerships and shared incentives is going to continue and pick up steam. And that's not just between providers and payers, but providers and other stakeholders, providers and their affiliated physicians, for example. One health system I work with actually had their physicians do a role play with their revenue cycle staff. And if you can imagine, this is hilarious, you know, thinking about physicians in the character of a biller or coder and vice versa. But it's very enlightening because they started to be able to figure out what are the things that the other side's doing that I don't care for, that I don't feel like are helpful to me, and it pulls those out. And as you start to figure out those things between stakeholders, whether it is between payer and provider, the goal going forward of creating less of a zero-sum game and less of that passive aggressive zero sum game behavior, because your revenue is my cost or your revenue is my cable payment from the patient side of it, those things are going to continue and accelerate as well.
Fascinating. You mentioned three big trends. Thank you. One, you mentioned the technology platform that's now in place that now allows technology and healthcare to move to a whole different level. So it was challenging to get that platform in place. It was extremely expensive for lots of systems and for the entire country. And at the same time, you couldn't do a lot of these next level things without that entire national platform in place in different ways. It's still evolving, but it's largely in place compared to where it was 10 or 15 years ago. And it's allowing these next generation of efforts. Fascinating perspective. The next thing, Jason, you said, which I thought was so interesting, it plays into something else, was this concept of the patient moving from passenger to driver. And what's fascinating about it is a lot of patients don't really want to move from passenger to driver, but they have no choice. There's just not enough care navigation resources in our country for them to be handheld in the kind of way they'd like to be through systems. There's just not enough resources, not enough labor for that. It's just not getting done. And so the patient, through technology and through need, necessity, is becoming this driver with lots of technology tools and transparency. And it's sort of a fascinating perspective on how this is happening. And I've not heard anybody say it before. So they're going from passenger of the car to driver, whether they want to or not, that's where it's moving.
Absolutely. And they're getting more help in that too, because there are more sources, more transparency, more things. You're seeing more players starting to try to put things into apps, you know, including the payers, including the providers, working with Apple HealthKit and things of that nature. So I think you're right. They have to be, because the incentives are there for them. But we're going to start to see more and better enablement for them to take the wheel.
No, exactly. It was so hard to do it some time ago, and it's becoming easier. It still is a big leap for a lot of people, of course, for a lot of us, but the tools are helping, and it's moving in the right direction. And by necessity, it's got to get better, because we can't afford all the navigators we need to not do it, on top of everything else. And another question I have, you've had a really remarkable professional career. You're a gifted person. Best advice for leaders, any thoughts and advice for leaders, for other leaders, you know, trying to grow professionally and be great leaders?
It's always an interesting question when you talk about leadership. I'm going to harken back to, you know, years ago in my past and say, I tell people, get in the trench sometimes. I did a stint in the military, in the Army. And one of the things that I observed or learned from that time was that when you have military officers, the ones that say wouldn't, do push-ups when they expect their troops to be able to do them, you saw this kind of phenomenon where people followed their orders, because that's what you do in the military, but it was mostly compliance. And when you had that officer that would come down and push with us, it created stories, because people recognized that effort. And two, it created a relationship equity that was very much different than kind of the standard chain of command sort of a relationship. And what that led to was their troops would exceed just following their orders. People would really go out of their way and try to impress them. People would try to protect those leaders and really have their back, as it were. And when you flip that over in a professional scenario, I'm not implying that means going down and micromanaging and being involved in everything that your teams are doing. But I think it's been helpful for me on the right occasions to demonstrate that I can, and there's a reason I got to the place that I'm in, and there are things that I know and things that I'm willing to do in certain situations. As example, if the team is shorthanded or under a crisis, and I think, you know, it generates that equity that I was talking about. But almost more importantly, as a leader, sometimes the stories that are created out of simple behavior that people model behind you, it just goes so much further than actions that you take on your own, because that kind of propagates the right sort of behavior, the right sort of culture that you'd like for your teams to participate in and to drive their decision making and their priorities.
Thank you. Such a critical part of long-term developing close relationships that you're actually willing to work, roll up your sleeves, be in the trenches with people. It doesn't mean every single moment or micromanaging, but working with them closely, and given the effort that you expect from them. A follow-on question to that, and it may be a similar question, but do you bring to what you do a core management or leadership strategy or philosophy?
I don't know if it's philosophy as much as priority. And I think maybe I've alluded to some of this, as you said, but I think of a couple of important and related ideas, which are purpose and people. Purpose by way of clarity on objectives, as I mentioned, you know, that's an important part of your strategic thinking, and people with regard to really caring for people in a genuine sense. And I think the latter, you know, the caring for your people, it buys you the type of equity that I was describing a couple minutes ago, when sometimes you need that equity because pursuing purpose and the mission of your organization sometimes requires making sacrifices and doing uncomfortable things. And when you have taken care of folks and, you know, worked to understand them and their motivators, their drivers, their incentives, when you try to give them opportunities to drive great careers and not just kind of order them to accomplish tasks, your team knows you don't take them for granted. And so when the chips get down, when, you know, there's some crisis that has to be managed or some tough decision making, that's when, you know, they're going to have your back. As I put it before, they're going to, you know, make that extra effort and really lock in when those things happen, because that's when you really test the strength of your organization and the strength of what you've been able to put in place from a strategy, culture, and management process standpoint is how do people respond when things are really critical.
And it's really this mix of what you mentioned, purpose and people. And it's not just this task which has to be done right and done well, but it's really concern about the person's entire career, that you're trying to inspire them to have a great career. Yes, the tasks and the career are intertwined, but the tasks are just one piece of a larger career and trying to have a great professional career. And that's and the inspiration you really want to have for people is that you want them that work with you to ultimately have a great professional career, not just do well this year, not just transaction, but a great professional career.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And I find that I think, you know, when you talk about paying it forward, you know, most of us have gotten to the positions that we're in because someone looked out for us and gave us mentoring to help us, you know, get down a path. I believe I've benefited from it, and I believe part of what I described and what you summarized is in that same vein.
Thank you, Jason Williams. What a crazily talented, intelligent, and pleasure of a person to visit with. Jason, I want to thank you for your time today. Always an unusual pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it.